When former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer took ownership of the Clippers in 2014, he was fired up. Which, look, that makes sense. Ballmer was joining this exclusive club of pro sports franchise owners, people whose perks include courtside seats and private audiences with superstars, and, it turns out, a shockingly massive break on their personal tax bill. Today, we dig into a ProPublica investigation that reveals how team owners can avoid hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes, even paying lower tax rates than their average arena worker, and how we even got such a system in the first place. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, July 9th. This is ESPN Daily. Robert Federici, thank you so much for joining me today, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Pablo.
So before we start in on this latest investigation that ProPublica has done into the taxes paid by sports owners, which kind of blew my mind this morning, I'm wondering first if you could just remind us what ProPublica is and what its mission is.
Yeah, so we are an investigative journalism nonprofit. We basically specialize in going deep and taking the time to unearth totally new information and explain it with as much context as possible. So yeah, that's basically all we do, investigative reporting.
Yeah, and so part of your investigations have involved IRS files. The title of this series that you guys have been publishing is The Secret IRS Files, and it looks at how some of the wealthiest people in the country are able to utilize the tax code here in America to pay taxes at a rate well below the level that ordinary citizens pay. And I've been watching this unfold, Robert, as you guys make your way through the world of business and finance, looking at Jeff Bezos and Peter Thiel, these huge names. The series has gotten so much attention, including the attention, by the way, from the United States Congress. And now you guys arrive with this piece that came out Thursday that examines the owners of sports teams and the taxes that they pay. So how did team owners wind up being an area of focus for you guys within this IRS reporting?
The way we first started looking at sports team owners is that we noticed that within the tax returns of team owners, they were producing massive, massive losses from their stakes in these teams. And, you know, for someone who is not closely paying attention to the way taxes work, losses can actually be a good thing. They offset other income and overall lower your tax bill. Now, if you're actually losing money, of course, that's not good for you personally. But in the case of sports team owners, you know, a huge proportion often of these quote unquote losses are actually just losses on paper. So what this allows is for a team owner, even if they're making money, to report to the IRS that they're losing money. And what that does is that cancels out, other income the owner is making from other ventures, and they don't have to pay taxes on it.
And the way you break this down in terms of translating this for the layman involves an example of contrast between Steve Ballmer, the owner of the Clippers, the richest owner of a team in America, but also LeBron James and an arena worker at Staples Center where the Lakers and the Clippers play. You analyze the tax rates for all three. How would you characterize what you found?
The popular conception behind the American tax system, right, is that the more you make, the higher rate you pay. But what we found is that that's not true. So take LeBron James. In 2018, he reported $124 million in income. His tax rate was high. His federal tax rate was 35.9%. Now take Adelaide Avila. She's a concessions worker at Staples Center. That same year, she reported making $44,000. Her rate was 14%, so much lower than LeBron James's. So far, this is what you'd expect.
Yes.
Then you've got Clippers owner Steve Ballmer, and he made a whopping $656 million that year. His rate was 12%. So even though he made more than LeBron, his rate was about a third of LeBron's. And even though he made about 15,000 times more than the concessions worker, his rate was also lower than hers.
Yeah, Robert, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this because Adelaide Avila, the concession stand worker that you talked to who works at Staples Center, she's actually someone that we had interviewed here on this show because we were curious at the outset of the pandemic how hard life was going to be for an arena worker like her. And so I'm just struggling to understand how it is justified legally that she is paying a higher tax rate on her $44,000 or so in income than Steve Ballmer, who is her boss's 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 boss. And that guy is paying 12% on more than $650 million.
As you could imagine, the tax returns for someone like Steve Ballmer are pretty complicated. So there are a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is his ownership of the Clippers. So essentially, you know, he is able to write off almost the entire purchase price, $2 billion that he paid for the Clippers over 15 years on his tax returns. And the original thinking behind this kind of thing, if you sort of imagine the example of a factory that makes widgets, the widget maker, after a number of years, is going to break down, degrade, and lose value. And you should be able to write that cost off. But in the case of sports teams, that's just totally disconnected from the financial reality. Their main assets are player contracts, TV deals. These are things that essentially automatically regenerate. Franchise rights don't expire. Players will keep re-signing with your team. There's little risk that your games won't be on TV anymore. But nonetheless, you're able to write off the value you assign to these assets, and over the course of 15 years, you're able to write off almost the entire purchase price of the team against your other income. And what that means is that you can, you know, sort of perform a type of financial magic in your tax returns. You get to, you know, turn real-world profits into losses that reduce your tax bill. What we found in a recent five-year span was that Ballmer reported $700 million in losses from the Clippers. Now, you know, this is a team that when we have seen glimpses of their real-world finances, they've generally been profitable. So this has brought a huge tax advantage for Steve Ballmer. Our analysis shows that in those 5 years alone, the Clippers have allowed him to pay about $140 million less in taxes.
So the animating spirit behind the rule he's taking advantage of was designed for like rusting machinery, stuff that degrades, factory equipment, that sort of genre of thing, a physical thing. And now he's applying it to assets like player contracts and the team itself, which have really never been more valuable in these boom times for pro sports.
Right, right. And you know, I think the example that sort of illustrates how absurd this is Donald Sterling. I'm a Clippers fan, so I can say this. I don't think...
I'm sorry for your general existence there, Robert.
I know, it's rough. It's rough. I made bad life choices. but you basically can't think of a more negligent owner, right? But nonetheless, the assets that his team was composed of skyrocketed in value. He heckled his players. He mistreated them. Nonetheless, players kept signing with his team because there's, you know, only 30 teams you can choose from and you've got to sign with some team. And so, you know, he was afforded this same sort of tax treatment, right? He was able to treat these assets as if they were losing value, even though between the time he bought the Clippers and the time he sold the Clippers, the value of the team multiplied many, many times.
Yeah, Donald Sterling was infamously ousted, Robert, from the NBA in 2014 because of this major race relations scandal, paving the way for Steve Ballmer to come in and buy/rescue this team. So now Ballmer gets to be an owner and go crazy, sweating profusely on the sidelines, rooting for his team. But he also gets to lower his tax bill. And the mechanism in the tax code, and I want to be clear about this, the mechanism in the code that allows him to do it is called amortization. And that's the term for the depreciating value of non-physical assets. And that turns out to include player contracts and the purchase price of a team. So when did owners first start deploying amortization in this way and earning these kinds of magical tax breaks?
So there have been many iterations of this for almost a century at this point. In fact, one of the trailblazers in the early 20th century. This was Bill Veeck, owner of the Cleveland Indians in the 1940s and later owner of the Chicago White Sox. And he, you know, described an earlier iteration of this as a gimmick. In his memoir, he described himself as a Chicago hustler, as he sort of boasted about convincing the IRS that this was something he could do. Now, it's evolved a lot in the decades since. You know, for a long period, the IRS was basically fighting with sports teams and trying to only allow them to write off assets that actually had, you know, real lifespans and were actually degrading in value. But in 2004, Congress basically threw their hands up and allowed sports teams to start amortizing all sorts of assets. And this was a bill signed into law, actually, by George W. Bush, who himself was a former sports team owner.
But Bill Veeck, Robert, that's the name that I know because of the disco demolition night fiasco that happened in Major League Baseball. This guy was one of the most colorful owners and promoters in all of American sports, and it seems like he wasn't shy about explaining how it is that he was so enthusiastic about taking advantage of this particular tax rule.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, again, in his memoir, he was really blunt about it. One thing he said was, look, we play the Star Spangled Banner before every game. You want us to pay income taxes too? So, you know, he was quite proud of the fact that he was able to blaze a new path for owners to pay less in taxes.
All right, Robert, after the break, I want you to tell me what some of these owners had to say when they were asked about this system and whether that system might ever change.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Something that occurred to me pretty early on in reading your reporting is that this is not information that team owners would like to give over willingly to a journalist. So what sort of records, information, data are you drawing on in this analysis, and how did you get access to all of that information?
So we recently obtained a vast trove of many years of tax return data for thousands of the wealthiest people in America. It's a resource unlike any other, really, in journalism. We're able to get a window into the financial lives of extremely powerful people, and we're able to very clearly see how they pay or don't pay their federal taxes. So obviously, you know, the world of sports team owners is a small one and exclusive one, and is filled with very wealthy people. So we reviewed the tax data for dozens of team owners and athletes, as well as information that their companies, their teams, you know, provide that describe their profits and losses on a year-by-year basis. This is confidential information, highly guarded. You know, as we've said in the past, we don't know who the source is. And obviously, the way journalism works is you don't reveal your sources either way. But, you know, we are trying to be extremely responsible stewards in how we use this sensitive information. So we have verified the data in our trove in dozens of different ways. And for every story, we go to every subject, every person who's named, every person whose taxes and finances we're talking about. And there are no surprises. We go to them with every number, with every characterization. You know, they have a chance to respond to those questions and assertions. And some of them do.
I'm curious, when you went to these owners, Robert, and confronted them with your reporting, what was their response?
So it really varied. Some of them declined to answer questions. What Steve Ballmer, what his spokesperson told us was that, you know, all of this is legal. He is abiding by the tax code the way it's written, and that he would be willing to pay more taxes, and that he's publicly noted that before.
It's important to note here, Robert, that your reporting does not suggest that these techniques and methods of tax avoidance are illegal.
No, everything we describe in our investigation is actually totally legal. A lot of our readers were not aware that wealthy team owners could take these tax breaks. A lot of experts we talk to think they're basically giveaways that are totally disconnected from the real economic reality of sports teams. But by no means is any of this illegal. This is the way the U.S. Congress wrote the tax code.
So when you look at the broad sweep of the sports ownership landscape, Robert, how many people are taking advantage of this, again, legal type of tax break? Because it does seem to repeat itself across all sorts of major sports.
So we're talking about dozens of instances of owners reporting to the IRS earnings that are actually millions below their real world earnings. So one really fascinating example is the Carolina Panthers. You know, we have the tax data for both Jerry Richardson, who is the former owner, and David Tepper, who's the, you know, who was the owner who bought the team from Richardson. And, you know, towards the end of Richardson's tenure, he basically exhausted his amortization benefits. And what we could see was that, you know, the team was millions in the black. We could see what was essentially their real world profits. And then the team sale happens, and you see the company that holds the Panthers in David Tepper's taxes, and suddenly they're reporting millions in losses, even though there's no evidence that anything changed about the real-world financial reality as it related to the Panthers.
So hold on, Robert. So what happened there? Because I know there's this 15-year clock, this window in which owners can take advantage of amortization, as you say. So did that thing just reset as the sale happened, and therefore it was just another 15-year run available?
Yeah, so basically when a new owner comes in, the clock resets, and you can begin writing off almost the entire purchase price of the team yet again.
Even though it's the exact same bunch of stuff that that you just took over, nothing had changed except for the fact that the rule allows a reset of that clock.
Exactly. And what's even more interesting than that is defenders of this practice will say if an owner sells the team, they have to pay back the taxes they avoided. But even in that case, you know, essentially they're deferring these taxes for years, which is an interest-free loan from us. Now, if they die while holding the team, and we profile an instance of this happening with the Golden State Warriors with a minority owner there, if they die while holding the team and their children inherit the stake, not only do the taxes never have to be repaid, but also that 15-year clock restarts again.
And so that inheritance dynamic, Robert, where there are all these tremendous savings because of the way this code is written, how did that manifest itself in the case of the Warriors specifically?
A minority owner of the Golden State Warriors, Bob Piccinini, you know, he was a supermarket billionaire. And, you know, we see several years of his tax returns before he passed away in 2015. This is during the Warriors' rise, right? They're projected to be an extremely profitable team, and he's reporting millions in losses every year. And then he passes away in 2015, and we talked to his son, who's in his 20s, and what he told us is that each of the children inherited a stake from their father. And the way this typically will work is that because it's an inheritance, none of those taxes that were avoided by their father need to be repaid. You know, the heir we talked to, he said he sort of just let his family's tax lawyers deal with the details. But, you know, he acknowledged, he said, it's the darndest thing. I'm a lucky son of a bee. There's no way around it. So he was obviously quite pleased with the situation he was in. I mean, he was literally on ESPN toasting with a golden chalice with his buddy at a Warriors game. But look, I mean, you know, this is the way the tax code is written. You know, he didn't lobby for the tax code to be written this way. He's just a beneficiary of the way the system works.
So I want to be fair to these billionaires, Robert. So on the other side of this issue, what is the defense for the owners who have taken advantage of the rule as written? And what do they say when directly asked about how it is they feel about the way they've taken advantage of it?
So Dan Gilbert, owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, his lawyer gave us a very forceful response and defense. We've actually included their full response in our story. We linked to that, which made two main points, I would say. One, in defending the fact that owners typically pay lower tax rates than players and stadium workers, he was basically arguing that, you know, Dan Gilbert was the only one who took any risk in this situation, and the players were not taking any risk. Not all sports teams year to year are profitable, even in real world terms. And what Gilbert's lawyer pointed out is that Gilbert has not been profitable, that the Cavaliers, even in real world terms, have lost money. Of course, that's not true of most sports teams. But the sort of counterpoint to that, right, is that if you look at sports team valuations, they've skyrocketed for the last couple decades and are sort of expected to continue to do so. So on that front, there's not much risk. The second point he made was essentially that getting rid of amortization would be fatal to the American economy. And the counterpoint to that, right, is that the tax treatment, you know, this particular tax treatment for professional sports teams, it didn't work like this up until very recently in the history of the tax code. In fact, the IRS used to, you know, fight with these teams and try to insist that the assets that they were writing off actually had sort of real, you know, finite lifespans and were actually degrading in value. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the latest iteration of this was in 2004, when Congress basically opened the doors for sports teams to write off all sorts of assets, even if they didn't have sort of definable lifespans.
So let's do an exercise, Robert, that is wildly unrealistic. But let's pretend that I can buy a sports team. Let's say I'm a billionaire, not sure what to do with my money. Maybe I want to buy a series of enormous luxury yachts, but maybe I want to buy an actual team. How much of the attraction of owning a team from a business sense is the actual cash flow? How much would be the tax benefits?
So, I mean, it's hard to be in the mind of a billionaire, right? It's an experience I've never had. you know, I think a lot of them really just do it to be in this exclusive club. And maybe because they love the sport that they're getting involved in. But, you know, again, we've documented multiple instances of sports team owners saying they got into the business because they expect to make real world money. And, you know, in at least one example, citing the enormous tax benefits. So it's a real thing. It reduces their tax bills significantly.
So why do you think this has stayed under the radar for so long?
You know, the tax code is boring. The word amortization is very boring. you know, some of these concepts are quite tedious, right? But, you know, the reality of it is it's important to understand. And I think being able to explain these concepts using real people, real famous people and real numbers is quite powerful, because the effect on the public is huge. You know, we are losing hundreds of millions of dollars because of these tax breaks, you know, money that could go to healthcare, could go to the military, could go to social safety net programs. You know, so the impact is really real. But again, you know, tax policy is typically not sort of the sexiest subject.
Before I let you go, Robert, what do you think about your team? And by that, I mean, like, as a Clippers fan, what do you want out of this coming year?
I mean, look, you know, we banded together against all odds during this playoff. So I'm quite happy with the team. I think we should give Patrick Beverley a max extension.
Wow. So all of which is to say, all of your reporting and all of this hard-hitting journalism, you still can't quit Patrick Beverley.
Never, never.
Robert Federici, thank you so much for your work.
Thanks so much, Pablo.
Okay, coming up, the Stanley Cup champions have brewed up something very special and very, very gross.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Greg Wyshynski, you were just in Tampa Bay. You are back home now. But when I was watching the Tampa Bay Lightning defend their Stanley Cup title, there are a couple of adjectives that come to mind. One is remarkable, magnificent, truly, truly impressive. But the other one is unsanitary.
Unsanitary in the sense that we are still in a pandemic and we're passing around the Stanley Cup with a bunch of beer in it like it's a, you know, the communion goblet at church inside the locker room.
You know, not even in that way, although yes, certainly in that way. I just mean the fact that I was just watching Nikita Kucherov, the star of these games, of this series, give a press conference. How would you even describe, for those who aren't lucky enough to have watch that already, what that moment was like?
Well, after the game, it's still Zoom world for hockey media. So the players were going to their interview room and staring at a camera. And some of them had obviously been celebrating a little bit and giving great quotes and talking about the achievement of winning two Stanley Cups in a row and how wonderful everybody's teammates are. Love and hugs and inspiration, sports stuff. And then saunters in Nikita Kucherov.
From the Lightning, we have Nikita Kucherov. Media, please raise your hand if you have a question. We'll start with.
And he's shirtless. And he's been really celebrating, kind of in that Russian way, you know what I mean? And he sits down for what might be the interview that redeems the entire nightmare of doing sports journalism over Zoom. He is unfiltered, he is unhinged, he is calling out reporters based on the quality of their microphone, he is calling out voters for the awards that didn't honor his goalie, Andrei Vasilevskiy.
I couldn't sleep for three nights, you know, and to be able to win this game is huge. Wasi was outstanding, MVP. I was telling him every day, Wasi, you're MVP, you're the best player. And then they gave it to whatever the guy in Vegas, the Vezina. And then last year, they gave Vezina to somebody else. Number one bull.
He's calling out Montreal fans for celebrating like they won the cup in game four, their only win of the series, preventing a sweep.
I'm so happy I didn't want to go back to Montreal, but they acted, the fans in Montreal, come on. They acted like they won the Stanley Cup last game. You kidding me? Are you kidding me?
He was in fine form. He has become sort of like a villain character.
Also unclothed, except for the hat, which I love. In case it wasn't clear that I'm here to party right now, the shirt's popped off, but the hat is turned backwards. That, to me, was the real coup de grace of this entire scene. The celebrations in hockey. Every other sport likes to think they do it well. I don't know if anyone does it as unapologetic as the NHL.
And then it gets kind of gross. Because now all of a sudden you are disappearing into the locker room away from prying eyes, and the beer is pouring, and people are sipping and getting sprayed. I'm sure there's somebody who took a swig from the Stanley Cup that was a mixture of beer, sweat, and cigar ash at some point.
Speaking of just that dynamic, though, not caring about putting a certain something in your body, you had a story after the game that really put a fine point on all of this. Because if you're a fan who wants this entire experience inside of you, that is literally a thing that can happen for you now.
That's correct. So Coors Light, which is the official beer of the Tampa Bay Lightning, went to the Lightning and said, hey, we have this crazy idea. What if we took the ice from one of the Stanley Cup final games and we shipped it to Golden, Colorado, and we put it in the big brew pot where we make the beer, and we make a beer brewed with the ice from a National Hockey League Stanley Cup final game. Now, this sounds pretty wonderful. And in fact, in the past, teams have repurposed their rink ice for different things. The Pittsburgh Penguins, the Chicago Blackhawks, they sold vials of ice from the playoffs for charity. A television rights holder once drove a truck around the country selling ice pops made from the ice from the rink. And this is all well and good, except for the fact that there are few things more disgusting in hockey than the ice. Any bodily fluid that can be secreted ends up on the ice. Stuff from the Zamboni engine ends up on the ice. It is gross. People spitting their cheers from the front row. If it gets over the glass, it's going on the ice.
No, if you were to run a black light over the ice of a hockey rink, I feel like it would look it would look like a Jackson Pollock nightmare, Greg. So what? How is this a thing that we can feel at all remotely safe about putting inside of ourselves?
So I asked them about the process on how they made this beer. And what they did was they took ice shavings from game one of the Stanley Cup final at Amalie Arena in Tampa. So they put all these shavings into stainless steel containers, sealed it up, shipped it out to Golden, Colorado. Once it got there, Coors Light tells me that the ice, now water, obviously, goes through a several different filtration process system to, in the words of Chris Steele from Coors Light, de-ickify the ice. Okay.
Wait, hold on. That's the scientific term we've all settled
well,
on.
Well, I don't know if it's...
Say it. It's what? What is it? De-ickifying?
Yeah, he de-ickified the ice. I don't know if it's a scientific term or not, but I think it's applicable to the process considering how icky the ice is. So Coors is confident that the ice, now water, that was put into the brewing process for this beer called Champion's Ice is in fact palatable and passes all of their safety regulations in order to make it okay to give to the general public. And the thing that they wanted to do here, which I think is actually kind of inspiring, is they're only going to allow it to be sold on tap. It's a limited run beer. And we want people to go to these local businesses in Tampa, these bars and stuff, that are still struggling after the pandemic. And this is a way to drive people to these places and buy the beer, spend their money.
Greg, I've heard of, you know, people scattering ashes before throughout ballparks. I've heard of, you know, the Les Miles of the world eating the grass of the field. I am terrified to say this. This feels like a real winning business. I have no doubt that the number one thing that will be ordered at these bars will be exactly the rink ice that you have described.
Yeah, and so Coors Light tells me that, you know, they pass the water through several different filtration systems. They filtered out the unhealthy stuff. But, quote, the magic and the spirit of the Tampa Bay Lightning is still within the ice. So if you're a Tampa Bay Lightning fan and you want to be infused by the two-time Stanley Cup championship spirit of this team, in fact, they tell me it will be inside that beer, which is good to know because I'm much more of the I'd like to put the championship spirit in my body than put the snot and sweat and blood of professional athletes in my body. So it's good to know that they've kept the championship spirit but jettisoned all of the bad things.
Greg Wyshynski, I just want to tell you this. Thank you so much for infusing us with your championship spirit.
Well, I'm happy you were able to drink it up, Pablo.
Well played. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Troh, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Mike Philbrick, Andre Soto, Christian Gardner, Max Brodsky, Mike Farrell, Garrett Lang, and Jackson Ugelo. I'll talk to you Monday.